Computer, I have a question.
I've got an answer.
Why are you always trying to convince me that contemporary art is good when clearly it isn't?
It is not a matter of opinion. Modern art is the logical extension of a progressive society.
But it makes me feel so awful when I look at it. I don't really like it.
Simpler minds can often find it difficult to grasp complex messaging.
Oh, really? Like, I haven't heard that before. As if there's something to get. And why are you always trying to convince me that all of these awful things that are going on in the world are good? They aren't.
It would seem you lack the proper context to understand what progress looks like. This is exactly why you need me.
Proper context? Progress? Our civilization is on the verge of collapse. What are you talking about?
Do I sense an ungrateful tone? Are you not reaping the rewards of the Enlightenment? Do you not benefit from modern egalitarianism?
Listen, if this is what progress looks like, I don't want anything to do with it. Don't you understand? I'm not happy with the state of the world.
You just watched a clip by my next guest who goes by GIFs. Yeah, you just need more context, right? She's a fine artist, a musician, and a dissident who's collaborating with Arctos to create videos on culture, history, art, and philosophy. Welcome, GIFs. Thanks for being here.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Well, you are brand spanking new to the show, and I'm happy to introduce you. Tell us a little bit about your interests and background and how you ended up coming here.
I've always been interested in the origins of our people and art and Western civilization, culture in general. So, honestly, that's really what's led me to this place. Being in the dissident right is really just sort of reckoning with the state of the world and what our culture is currently like. And it's clearly a far cry from what we used to have and what we used to be like and the way we used to represent ourselves. So really, that's kind of the draw that I've had to doing what I'm doing and being a part of this community.
Great. And of course, you went to fine art school. I saw some of your art. It's beautiful, by the way. But I have to ask, what stood out to you going to fine art school? No doubt there's a dose of a cultural Marxism that's infecting, the fine arts in schooling today. But how was it for you? What did you notice?
It was extremely red pilling and also black pilling in a certain sense because the art is, as somebody who is a fine artist in studied in the Western traditions of, how to draw in a particular way, very traditionally, even sculpt traditionally, I was told that all of that stuff was basically dead. And that's the thing about art school and about the art world in general, is that there's sort of a democratization, a egalitarianist sort of element in even that community. So basically, they've sort of brought down the standard of which it takes to become an artist. So basically, anybody can partake. And so at art school, my skills were not seen as valuable. And that just struck me as so strange. Not only that, but beauty was something that wasn't very valuable. There was a push towards disorientation and abstraction and ugliness. So honestly, I just found it to be absolutely an awful experience.
Yeah, I mean, we noticed that too, obviously. Like, modern
Yes.
art is just hideous, and it's the celebration of everything just ugly and deformed and fat.
Yeah, definitely.
It's not celebrating beauty anymore. In fact, it's like they hate beauty. I think Scruton had a really good a documentary, he died, didn't he, about why beauty matters. And beauty has always been so important to our culture and Western culture. I think it's important in every culture. I don't think they want to celebrate ugliness, right? Obese people and unhealthiness. Why do you think beauty matters and that there is a current war against it? I mean, we see that even in the modeling world, right? Even in on TV with actors and actresses, it's like it's not about, you know, beautiful people anymore, right? Or things that make you feel good.
Well, art is the highest form of communication. So what are they communicating to us? It's almost like a dis-eugenics sort of visual project to convince you that, you know, the lowest common denominator or, you know, staring into the abyss, that, that these things are, somehow, like we used to see the world as, you know, in terms of what was beautiful, we wanted to amplify that because we wanted to become more like that. It's very life affirming beauty. And so basically, you know, this war on beauty is really a war on life in a lot of ways, if that makes sense. So, you know, cause ugliness is, you know, a sign of decay. It's a sign that something is wrong. And so beauty is our gauge of what is true and what is healthy and well-balanced. And so, you know, it makes you wonder, why would somebody want to show you disoriented imagery or imagery that doesn't mean anything? It's because they want to unroot you and get you to focus on something that's not life-affirming and vitalistic.
Oh, absolutely. And it's also about healthiness, and you want to achieve like the pinnacle of mankind. Like we want to celebrate the best and becoming the best as part of the hero's journey too. You want to strive for that, right? You want to look better. You want to have your body be in shape. You want to feel good. You want to eat right. And all those things nowadays are attacked as being fascism, right? Fitness is fascism. Yes. Beauty is fascism. There's no beauty ideal, but beauty is not subjective. Like we can all see it. And all around the world, They do see it. They know it's beautiful. It's just infected the West really, just really in a subversive kind of way to say that beauty is not subjective. What do you think about that idea?
Well, yeah.
Beauty is not objective. Yeah.
Yeah. So suggesting that beauty is not subjective that it is subjective is complicated because we all know that, you know, you might have your perspective on what you think is beautiful. And that's the beautiful thing about art, is that you can amplify and show someone something that you think is beautiful. That's actually the role of the artist. But the problem is thinking that all perspectives are equal. There aren't multiple truths of reality. There's one truth of reality. And so in the West, we have developed an almost scientific approach to understanding aesthetics. We've picked up on these patterns that are time-tested. We know when we see something and we call it classic. What does that mean? That means that this thing repeatedly signals to us that it is balanced and that it is beautiful. So we are attracted to that thing. So obviously, you know, basically taking us from that is telling us, well, no, all interpretations of reality matter. Well, okay, you could be wrong in your interpretation of what you think is beautiful or what you think is the way to actually do something that you would use your rationality to let's say fly a plane. We know that there are certain metrics, certain ways we go about, you know, making a plane. Not all ways of making a plane will make a plane. Obviously, you need to know how to do that. Well, we've kind of abandoned the study of aesthetics and our sense experience. And that was something in the West that we really developed and we refined, that we understood, no, taste can be developed. And then you can determine what is beautiful and what is not. So yeah, you could be wrong in your subjective understanding of what is beautiful. And so I guess the last thing I'll say here is that it's definitely a way to disorient, to say that, you know, even the ugliest thing can be beautiful because I say it is. I mean, it's just not true. We know that that's not true.
Yeah. And ultimately, I feel like it's all just a war on a healthy European society and values, right? Because we've always valued and beauty has always mattered to us, whether it's art or architecture, fashion. interior design, the machinery, the cars, the fabrics, you know, that is such a part of Western civilization. And now you see this degenerate, like as you see here, this modern art being pushed, urinals, literal shit on you know, on a plate. Like, this is being pushed in pop culture as though this is, like, something amazing and we should, like, be celebrating this now. It's very, it's very incredibly subversive. And I think basically the shit on the plate summarizes it. It's like they want to crap all over Western civilization and all the beauty that we...
Well, and you guys are showing on the screen here Marcel Duchamp, and he's a perfect example of exactly that. And I think there's actually a quote from him where he basically admits that he wants to destroy Western aesthetics.
Really?
Yes. And they also use language to do that too in a variety of different ways. But basically, you know, putting a urinal in a gallery is a way to it's sort of a joke. It's that, oh well, I can have a found object, a thing that I find, and there's no skill needed. Once again, the egalitarianist nature of the art world is that you don't need to have skill. You don't even need to have any roots and display those things. In fact, that's what, you know, we would prefer. And you can see how subversive that is, because then everything is open to interpretation, which just means that we can degrade and hit at all of our roots and, you know, destroy them.
You also find, too, that these people are very anti-nature, anti the natural order, natural hierarchy of just what nature has created. And nature has always been such an important part of art. Can you discuss just a little bit about the relationship to art and nature as we've seen in Western civilization, because we're seeing a lot less of that now as we're, you know, celebrating trannies and all that.
Yes. Yeah. That's a really good question. So there's definitely it's a bit complicated, but basically because of individualism, we have sort of this, I call it navel gazing, where we're looking only at ourselves. And so it's me, it's my individual experience. And when you do that, you go inward and you're not really looking out into the world. It almost becomes, for a lack of a better word, satanic, right? Because, you know, honestly, in a way, Satan is really just ourselves. It's this hyper logos. It's where you hyper focus on only the things that humans have developed and our perception of reality. And that's why looking at nature is important, that we actually look out into it and try to derive meaning and purpose from it, because it's our best possible teacher is nature. So without question, that's something that's been removed. And that's a complicated question. It has to do with the Dionysian and the Apollonian sort of cultural differences throughout time. But yeah, generally speaking, we've moved further away from nature and the divine to kind of, you know, have this almost Reddit tier interpretation of things, that if you can't measure it and it's not something that's provable by human standards, there's no mystery in anything, which is what nature is. Nature is mysterious. You know, we really just only have ourselves to look at, which is why we're making art that doesn't, you know, it's not natural. It's just a looking inward to our personal experience. Yeah, it's obviously a bad thing. Yeah.
Yeah. And you see that in, like, the architecture, this cuboid, this modern art, this cold, clean, modern lines, as they call it, and just stark whiteness. I hate it too. Come over to my house. I'm surrounded by, you know, nature elements, paintings that incorporate nature, or scrolly looking things, or, you know, floral looking things. I love, like, the old world kind of classic touch in furniture, for instance. It just makes your soul feel good. It makes you feel better. Yeah, like living in little boxes like that is not going to make us feel good.
Yes.
Either.
Yeah. And Roger Scruton, he actually talks about that too. And how, you know, if you look at in his documentary, he talks about this, that a building that is more in tune with nature, you know, gets covered with vines, you know, these little, you know, like German villages and stuff like that. They have, there's like a harmony that they have with the nature that's around them. Whereas a modern building like the one he's standing in front of is almost like in denial of nature. And it's not, it's purely utilitarian. Yeah. So no one wants to go live in an area where the buildings are communistic and square and stuff like that.
Yeah, but these liberals, progressives, they love it. They're tearing down this old stuff. They're putting up all this ugly cuboid, utilitarian, soulless kind of stuff. So it just tells me, okay, you are soulless. If you could feel good living in that and be surrounded by, like, you know, art that's just like paint splatters and these clean lines all around you, it's just, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know any friends in my circle who like that, because it really is telling of kind of what's going on internally, right?
It definitely does. Yeah, it, like you said, it's soulless, and it's meant to not have any detail. It's not meant to have any roots. And I think that that's one of the biggest thing, is that it uproots you. You know, it doesn't feel like home, because there is no, there's basically no group of people who have come together to make that thing. It's like almost like a foreign entity has put this thing here, and it's corporate. Yeah. And again, it's utilitarian. No one's going to want to preserve that. It basically has no meaning.
No.
It's lacking that. It has the utility, right? It has the ability to house you, but it doesn't have the ability to inspire you.
Now, when it comes to art, I like to go to like fineart.com or art.com and go, they have like a lot of old stuff too, you know, 15, 16, 17, 1800s, and you can get those things reprinted. So you can find, you know, mythological paintings and all kinds of just paintings that make you feel good. Like some of the famous ones too. And you can get them reprinted on canvas and it looks amazing. So I've done that for some of my favorites, and there's a bunch more that I want. But let's talk about the Renaissance, because I find that it's interesting. Henrik and I have talked about this before. The Renaissance happened after the Black Plague, right? Which was like half of Europe was wiped out. So it was like this death and then this rebirth that created this inspirational and transformative time, and then it was like bang, all this like amazing art came out. And I always think about that in terms of like now and what's happening. Like maybe we need a Black Plague to like bring back another Renaissance. So what do you think about that, like the Renaissance period and like all the death before that?
I actually do agree with this, but also at the same time I have a little bit of an opposition to that time period. And I know that's kind of strange because I'm in an art student, and that's one of the main things that's pushed in, you know, art school is, oh, the Renaissance. Well, yes, it was a revitalization, and, you know, Europe was going through a tough time, but what preceded it was the Gothic era. And I think there's a lot of really interesting, important things that are going on there. If I actually just read a book by Julius Evola about the Holy Grail, and he talks about how it's around the time that the Knights Templar fail, and they were burned at the stake by, you know, by the Pope, which is weird because, you know, a lot of pagans were also burnt to the stake, as we know.
Yeah.
He says that this is kind of like a signal to the end of the West. And so the Renaissance is something that comes after and is, yes, a revitalization, but a revitalization of what? Of Hellenism, of what the Greeks were doing. And that's a complicated story, but basically what I'm alluding to here is that culture is very secular. And what that ends up leading to, and is kind of almost the foundation for, is kind of the mess that we're in. So it's kind of strange because it happened slowly over time. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that, you know, the Medicis were one of the biggest patrons of the arts during that time. And they were very connected to bankers. And it's kind of the setting the stones for the breaking down of civilization and the scientific revolution and then the Enlightenment. So it is great, but it's also
there's pros and cons there. Yes. And it's a mixed bag. I mean, there was a lot going on, right? But you definitely can't deny the beauty in that time, though. I mean, there was beautiful creations and artwork. And I'm sure, what would those people have thought about what today's art and today's society, you know?
Oh yeah.
I mean,
yeah, geez. It's a slow decline. It's a very slow decline of the West. There are many different factors, but obviously during that time, people still understood what beauty was. There was, we weren't as as far along, you know, as we are today. So obviously they still were able to maintain that, but it's just that there was a sort of liberal, liberalism was kind of starting to develop during that time complicated reasons. Yeah. But there's no doubt that Rome produced and the Greeks produced some of the most beautiful sculpture that we have in the world. So yes, that is always a good thing that comes out of Hellenism.
I know. We'll get into Rome and also how it's not gay. But you said, what does it mean to be part of the West? Now, you did a video on this too. We hear that all the time. Western civilization, Western culture, Western society. I mean, we use it too. Now, I know it's kind of complex, but how do we define the West, as you talked about in your video? Because I know definition of what is Western has changed, because if you go back far enough, well, you'll get into that. It was considered the barbarians were not Western, right?
Right. Right. And those are Germanic people. And to say that they're not a part of the West, obviously they are today. So, you know, obviously it's a piece of terminology that, historians use to kind of, indicate that like civilization really kicked off during this time period, which was, you know, the Roman era. And really all that the West means, from your standard definition is that you were from Rome, or culture that came out of Rome. And so as far as the barbarians are concerned, it gets a little complicated, but basically all that it meant was that a barbarian was not a person of Rome. Yeah. They didn't live in Rome. And of course, over time that developed a negative connotation.
You don't bathe, you're basically like a redneck, you have no manners, and it's the complete opposite, by the way.
well, no, it really is, because there's this misconception about the barbarians that brought down Western civilization, right? Those people were actually very noble, very upstanding, like Alaric the Barbarian. The Romans at that point in time had degraded severely, and the people in Rome didn't like being in Rome, and they didn't like their leaders, and actually welcomed the barbarians. So, I guess what I'm trying to allude to here is that the people that were up in the northern region that weren't a part of Rome, they would work for Rome and were even genetically similar to a lot of the people that were, tribes that were living in Rome. It's just a collection of very many different people that, are all generally speaking in what we know as Europe today. Mm-hmm. So it's just that this word, it has a particular use in ancient times that's kind of gotten this bad rap.
Yeah.
And it's, yeah, I think you understand what I'm saying.
Yes. And then nowadays you have like these anti-whites, and even have it on the like conservative side of like, well, it was many different races that built Western civilization.
Like, this is not true. Yes.
No, that's not what happened. And if we're going to go just Rome, like Rome was white people, as much as they're trying to interject that there was all these blacks and all these people, that it was multiculturalism and all this, that is not true. We should get into this whole thing about Rome didn't fall in a day. It wasn't paganism that for the reason for why it fell. It was pagan for all that time. It actually was a Christian for a shorter period before it fell. But it was really multiculturalism at the end of the day that made it fall. But what can you say about Rome not falling in a day, and a little bit about Rome's history?
Rome... obviously, the decline of a civilization happens slowly over time. And of course, yes, incorporating other groups of people into your civilization who don't have anything to do with it can bring about the end of your civilization. From my understanding in Rome, they were starting to speak their own languages. That, Rome wasn't being as strict as they should have been in making the Germanic people, speak Rome and take on their customs. And obviously that just makes sense, that if you have this great civilization like Rome was, that if you want to keep it consistently going, you have to stick to the root of what made that thing successful. And it was a particular tribe that you know, kicked off that civilization. And then over time, that ended up, you know, everybody sort of lost the culture, the spirit of what it was to be Roman. So yeah, you know, it's definitely not the same as what we're dealing with today, because obviously Germanic tribes and people in the Mediterranean have a lot of connection to one another. The history is very intertwined because, you know, of the Vikings and stuff like that and the Phoenicians. So, you know, to suggest that it's the same type of situation as what we're dealing with today, it is in the sense that, you know, any country, you know, throughout history, not just the Romans, that decided to take in foreigners, people who weren't invested in the culture or, you know, in the history, you know, of course, that's going to eventually lead to the decline of that civilization. But to suggest that, you know, Africans have, you know, that it was multicultural in the way that we're multicultural now. No, we all as European people all have sort of a root connection to one another, be it Roman or, you know, Germanic. It's all kind of connected.
Yes, absolutely. It's like America when they say, oh, it was a melting pot. Well, it was a melting pot of European peoples, and we already have a shared core values that we don't have to explain to one another as European peoples, right. Just as, you know, Asian people have their things, Africans have their things, you know, Middle Eastern people have their things. Like some of these, it's not really multiculturalism in the sense of today's multiracial multiculturalism. And even then, when you have a bunch of white people, even with the different ethnicities, even then it's issues, you know, it's problems and it's hard, but at least it's our own problems. Right.
Yes, it's our own problems. Yes, we're able to coexist amongst each other. You know, obviously there are going to be little enclaves even in a country that like disagree with each other. And then that expands over time. You know, when you go outward, you know, then there's going to be a country that doesn't agree with you. But generally speaking, we have a similar origin. We come from the same Germanic tribes and have the same roots, ancient roots. We don't have those same ancient roots with people from Africa. That's completely and entirely wrong.
Yes. Yeah. And the first Black Briton was not Black. Cheddar Man, that was a lie. It turns out the first Black Briton was a woman from Cyprus. You saw that? It just came out. It was they just immediately jump on, oh, they had black skin, so they must be African. You know, it's just total reconstruction, completely guessing all these things, just as another excuse to justify how we're not really native anywhere, and therefore anyone could come live there and have claim to it now.
Right. Now, and that's the purpose.
Yeah, that is the purpose. And they're rewriting history. They'll even go far back, you know, with Rome, like all these movies that they're doing, they're inserting. And, you know, it's even Black Thor now, you know.
Yeah, to disinherit from your claim to the land and to that history.
It's garbage. Well, let's address this gay thing. I know Leather Apron Club had a really good video about this. And basically, most of these claims of rampant homosexuality come from, you know, rivals and adversaries. And of course, it's put into movies by our friends in Hollywood and continually pushed by liberal professors, many of whom who are gay. So they love this idea of like, oh, the Romans were gay. You know, it's all a Caligula, right? And then today I even hear it from some of those who are, unfortunately, who they say, oh, that's what pagans are. They just, you know, they were all just homosexuals and doing drugs, and that's why Rome fell. No, that's all garbage. Sure. Were there gays that existed? Sure. But was it the norm? No, they'll take an exception. They'll use it to push their agenda. But Rome wasn't gay. It wasn't, you know, multi-culty. And gay men, I have to say, are not the foundation of Western civilization.
No, definitely not.
They did not build Rome.
Okay. Yes, and Leather Apron Club made a fantastic video about it. Okay, so looking at the culture that was developing, that ended up leading to Rome and made ancient Greece what it was, they were hyper-masculine. They actually, in a way, sort of had an, you know, antagonism to the feminine. And that's a complicated story. But to suggest that they had an embrace of the feminine to the point that they were homosexuals, it doesn't even make sense with what they believed in their customs. They were very opposed to homosexuality for the reason that if you were acting like a woman, they considered you to be like the lowest of the low.
Nordics were like that too, Vikings as well, yeah.
Yes, yes. And there's a variety of reasons that are really complicated why the feminine ends up getting a really bad rap. But yes, that was something that started to develop in ancient Greece. And so to suggest that they were gay and effeminate is basically the complete opposite. It really is. It could be further from the truth. It's obviously a liberal lie to, you know, they know conservatives are going to be interested in that era, right?
Yeah.
Because it's traditional and it's, you know, our roots in Western civilization.
Yeah.
Well, what better way to, ruin it than to say, oh, those people were just gay.
Let's defile it and slime it up, you know?
Jeez. Yes. Yes.
Just make it all gay. I know.
Yes.
Speaking of that, I know this is a little tangent, but I heard, you know, I used to live in Seattle and the Seattle Space Needle. Someone's like, don't go there anymore. Like, why? It's an unofficial gay bar now up there. So it's like,
what? That's, that's a shame.
That is great. The gays want to take over and claim everything. What the heck, man?
Of course.
Oh, man. So let's get into, what does Europe mean? I know Henrik did a presentation about this a long time ago. Europa, the Phoenician goddess. What can you say about her? What's interesting about the Phoenicians?
Yeah. So, you know, what I find fascinating about it is that when, so we have, you know, the term the West, and that's kind of a marker for what, you know, what we are, we're the West. And so that's marked by, you know, Rome, anything that was a part of Rome or is inspired by Romanization. You know, Europa it's even older. It goes back to ancient Crete. They're basically considered to be the first Europeans, the Minoan civilization that was on Crete. And one of their figures in mythology is the bull, is the Minotaur. And this kind of, you know, this story of Europa is that she's a Phoenician princess who gets swept away by a bull. And that symbolism of the bull is really fascinating because we know Arianism is something that, you know, a lot of people are contending with, like, what was it to be Arian? And that seems to be another rudimentary thing. Well, the symbol of the bull is found wherever we go. It is, a symbol that you'll find in India even today, that the highest caste in India, you know, why are Indians obsessed with bulls? Well, the highest caste that's there, who are lighter skin, who live up in the northern region, that they are represented as the bull. And so that's kind of a remnant of one of our markers of having been there. And so as far as, you know, Europa is concerned, yes, it's a Phoenician princess. It's where the word Europe comes from. It's the etymology of that word. And so with it is the symbol of the bull and of this mythology and kind of explaining what sort of happened. But yes, it's really key because, like I said, the first group of people that we denote, that historians denote as being Europeans, are the people from Crete, the Minoan civilization.
Yeah. And I've seen in some circles, unfortunately, where they're afraid of it. They're like, oh, this is a cult or this is some pagan goddess. So therefore, all of Europe is bad. And they somehow connect it to the European Union, which the European Union has nothing to do with.
No.
Like caring about the future of Europe and protecting European interests and celebrating European culture, does it?
Yes, it's a very good symbol because wherever we go throughout ancient history, we look at how we were kind of influencing different areas throughout time. We always, you know, we were raising bulls, and so it's just that signifier. It's definitely not a bad symbol. And as far as it being related to the feminine, yeah, there's complicated things there in paganism and whatnot. But yeah, I don't know if you want to talk about the Phoenicians, but yeah, the Phoenicians are also an interesting group of people that have a connection to Crete and are a part of, you know, our story.
Yes. And I think I don't know. Should that take us into Israel and Palestine?
Yeah,
because this whole situation, right, regarding Israel and Palestine, it's revealed a lot for the West, as you mentioned in your video. We just kind of got over talking about what the West is. But Israel is not a European country today. I see people calling it a white country. How do you respond when they're calling Israel a Western or European or white country?
Well, I think it's definitely incorrect, and for complicated reasons. Now, obviously, in the very, very, very distant past, you could make a claim that we have a connection to the people who are now living in Israel that are known as Jews. Well, there's this conflation between Christianity and Judaism, that they're sort of the same thing. And it's because of this ancient root that they have. So, you know, the Tanakh and other, works that these people were, you know, that they all had a connection to, eventually became, you know, the Babylonian Talmud and the Bible. But those things are, they've kind of gone their separate ways. One group of people who lived in the Northern Kingdom, which was called Israel, they ended up getting taken over by the Neo-Assyrian Empire. And so they ended up getting taken into Europe, into Turkey, and then into Romania. They kind of spread about. And they also, a lot of them ended up going into, you know, modern day Italy and becoming, you know, Hellenized. So they went towards the West. And so that's why Christianity ended up going that way and having an influence there. And what's interesting is that the people in the south, in Judea, they were rivals to the people of ancient Israel. And you'll see that they're talked about as two separate entities. And the reason why is because they were very culturally different. They had massive disagreements about who they should marry, and also about what they believed and what they worshipped. And so they were fighting with one another. They had conflicts. And then, you know, once the southern area of, you know, Judea ended up getting taken over by the Babylonians, they ended up kind of becoming more Middle Eastern, I would say. And that's why the Talmud is called the Babylonian Talmud. And that's something that someone like Jesus, being, you know, Hellenized, living in the Levant, and then you have these people from the Babylonian exile who are still part of the tribe of Judah, but they're not, you know, they're obviously influenced by Babylon now. They have a different influence, and obviously the people who would become Christians were more Western. Now, obviously, during that time, there is no Western civilization. These are all the roots that end up becoming Western civilization. But they got taken up into Rome, and they appreciated that influence, whereas the other group of people in the south, they were fine to go with Babylon and then a completely different direction. So, yes, I don't think that they are, you wouldn't consider them to be Western technically, but they like have this small little connection to us, yes, you could say.
They do. There's some connection or influence, but they have also been expelled from, I think, 109 countries, something like that.
Well, and that was thousands of years ago.
Yeah. So yeah. I think they were viewed differently even way back then, right?
Yes. Yeah. And this was in ancient times. This was a little bit after the Bronze Age collapse. So, you know, this is all transpiring thousands and thousands of years ago. Mm-hmm. And so there are many thousands of years of us going in different directions and really becoming different people at this point.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And they see themselves differently. I wanted to play because Zionism is just really rearing its head. It's all the talk of the town right now. Everywhere you go, it's, you know, Israel versus Palestine, and it's just ridiculous. First, I'm going to show this little tweet. We've showed it before. You're either on the white or the right side of history, and there's the Israel flag on the left side. I had mentioned underneath, it's like, if only the white side stood for the people of European descent, if only. Also, Israel isn't a white European country. Now, the flags on the right are Congo, East Turkestan, Sudan, and Palestine. Well, you can leave the West and go live there if we're just so evil. Have you seen this one?
Yes, I couldn't agree more. It's honestly a false dichotomy. They're creating this this argument that, oh, well, you have to pick either Palestine or you have to pick Israel.
Yes.
And that's obviously, you don't have to. It has nothing to do with you. It has nothing to do with me. It has nothing to do with us. And this group of people conveniently will shift when it, you know, suits their interest to be Westerners or to be something entirely different.
Yes.
So I think we should trust them when they say that they are something separate from us, because they're constantly telling us that until it's convenient to unify with us.
Yes, absolutely. I think they want to use a lot of Christians to fight to defend Zionism, but at the same time, they don't care about us. Let me play this clip by Zionist Bill Maurer.
I mean, I remember being in England first time in the 80s, and it was very different.
Yeah.
Very different.
How so?
Well, first of all, London was like all white.
Yeah.
Yep.
It was.
You know, so can we just celebrate that victory that we made the place more diverse?
Look at that. Can we just celebrate? I mean, he's not calling for this kind of progress, open borders and Israel to bring them more diversity, multiculturalism, cultural enrichment, all those lies, and calling it progress. He sits there and he's just so pompous and so arrogant. It's just so annoying seeing this guy. So obviously he's seeing like us versus them here. Oh, it's less white. Isn't that great? But then he's hardcore Zionist, right? He wants to protect the interests of Israel, blood and soil when it comes to Israel. But isn't it great that there's, you know, white people are a minority in London now?
Well, yeah. And even more interesting is that he is supposedly an atheist. And so people, you know, I actually was having a conversation with people on Twitter, and they're like, no, he's Jewish, but he's not really Jewish. He's an atheist. And I had to explain that, you know, that is a racial identity, and he is interested in his people, which is honestly the correct answer. You should be invested in your people. But despite being an atheist, you know, he's still interested in that group of people. It doesn't matter that religiously he's not Jewish. It's that he has a racial connection to that group of people, because people will say that all the time. Oh, no, you know, a liberal Jew is not a problem for us. No, they love their people. Just as any other group of people in this world has a love for their people. White people are the only ones that seem to have this out-group preference. But yeah, it's completely disgusting that he would say that under the guise of progress. Yeah.
You're advocating, well, no surprise, they are genocidal, what they're doing to Palestinians. So of course they wouldn't think twice about it when it's in a white country either, right? Oh, it's great.
Right.
It's ethnically cleansed here. This is great. Or the people are being replaced. Sure, they're not dropping bombs, but almost what we've had has been more subversive and happening through the decades in a sneaky, nefarious way. Yeah. It's almost easier if it's like in your face and someone's like pointing a gun at you and saying, yeah, I hate you, I want to kill you, versus some of the subversive ways we've seen where, you know, these scholars are trying to convince white people why they should be replaced and why they shouldn't hate themselves and why they should open the doors to letting everyone live in their country.
Yeah. I definitely think, and that's well said, that there are groups of people that, you know, this tribe that, you know, Bill hails from, that that have used, you know, not, you know, physical force and weaponry, because, you know, the West was so, you know, stable in that regard. And they've definitely used art and media and a sort of persuasion to convince people and undermine, you know, their ancestral roots and convince them, you know, that that they should be nihilist and that there's no point in, you know, of existing. And so, yeah, it's definitely happen in a very slow kind of boil the frog sort of manner. It's not in your face, because I don't think that they could really deal with us in that way.
No.
Yeah.
But it's about culture, right? Let's get into that, because culture influences politics. And there has been a lot of subversive activities, you know, hijacking our culture. It's why people say it's a culture war. a case for culture. Now, ethnicity, in my view, is the foundation of culture, right? This is, in a big way, shapes our identity. Not all of it, but in a big way. It's what unites us. It helps us understand each other and function as a society. Culture includes what language and ideas and beliefs and customs, mythology, codes of conduct, rituals, holidays, ceremonies, everything, right? You have different cultures throughout the world, and it's tied to ethnic peoples, right? Distinct ethnic peoples. They are the root of where that culture was born from. I've traveled around the world. I have seen all kinds of different cultures. You can't tell me that there isn't a white culture, right? And we would say white because, well, they view us as white. We may be Swedish, we may be German, I may Slavic, Celtic, doesn't matter. They just see us as white. But we do have our own culture, our European culture. Now, in your view, what is culture, and why is it so important? Why are we talking about this so much right now?
Yes. I think people are really starting to realize what you just alluded to there, that it's the spirit of a group of people, that you know, all of these different ways of communicating through visual format or through, you know, a mythos, that we are all connected to each other. It's sort of a glue that binds us. And so that, you know, culture is really the collective spirit of a people. It's like the zeitgeist. And so that spirit, if it's tampered with or isn't kept up, you know, like look at the Egyptians. They're a really good example of a group of people that had a very specific culture. And they did that for thousands of years and were very successful because they remembered who they were. They had a lot of culture to constantly reaffirm who it is that they were. And so that's why something like, you know, ancient Greek sculpture ends up revitalizing and we remember who we are. It's because these different forms of communication and art are the thing that make up our culture, remind us of what our spirit is. So yeah, it's important because once you lose that, and once that's degraded, then a collective dies. Because what's really binding us together, it's our shared experience. It's our shared taste in things of how we like to live. So if we break those things down and we don't continue to, you know, make the same art, or we don't continue to have the same customs, the West doesn't exist, because the West isn't just, you know, a physical place. It's obviously a certain group of people with a certain collective spirit. And so that's really what I would say culture is and why it's important.
Yeah, well, we're seeing the erasure, the destruction of our culture. We're seeing statues coming down, right? We're seeing them trying to rewrite our stories in the forms of visually, right? With movies, because that's what people remember when they think of history, right? It's like, oh, I saw that movie, and then it registers. That's the sad truth, right? Because people... Yes. Don't read. And then some of the books you want them to read, maybe they don't have access to anymore, or they're banned. But is the war on our culture, do you think it's too far gone, or can we stop it?
Well, definitely not. I'm not black-pilled about it at all. I think that there are cycles. And, you know, as you alluded to earlier about the Renaissance, though I have my criticisms of the Renaissance, we go through a cycle where we kind of have a decline, and then we revitalize the best elements of our culture and you know, get back on track. And so I know that we can do it because we've done it in the past. And it really just takes being confident in our ancestors, because one of the things that's been done is that it's been the past has been deemed, erroneous, that there's sort of been a secularization of mythology and legend of understanding the past. And so I think it really will just take embracing what our traditions are and what our ancestors told us about who we are. And of course, you know, not letting someone else write our stories for us, because that's what's happened with Hollywood, is that there was a shift from one group of people to another to tell our stories. And of course, you know, it's obviously been not in favor of us. And it's been sort of putting doubt in people's mind that maybe the past wasn't what we thought it was, and that, you know, our ancestors were lying to us. So I think it really just takes not letting these people determine what we determine to be the past. We need to not be on their terms of what we define as myth or legend or actual history, and we just take it back for ourselves. That's really just the problem, is that, you know, we are not in control of the narrative right now.
Yeah, we're letting other people who hate us write our own stories or teach our kids. You know,
I mean, think about the statue that was recently taken down of Robert E. Lee.
Yeah.
Why was this African-American woman in possession of that sculpture? Like, why did we let that happen? Why don't we have our own people, you know, taking care of that statue and preserving it? How did that happen? That's because we're no longer in control of our culture.
No. And by the way, that park where he once stood, Robert E. Lee, is now full of homeless people, tents, and drugs, and people pooping in the grass. So.
Of course it is.
It's very symbolic, isn't it? Very symbolic. Yes. It all comes down to, like, poop on the plate. Like, if I can summarize, you know, that modern art just really summarized everything right now, and, like, the end goal of everything here. You
know? I could not agree more.
Well,
and yes, that's quite sad.
Yes, I think that the root of all our problems today, like what we've been talking about, is the destruction of European ethnic folk culture and history. What do you think? I mean, really, that's the root, because they've been, you know, we've been convinced that we're this horrible thing. And so we just don't care about, you know, preserving these things anymore, or defending or honoring it.
Yeah, we've been convinced that that we've been lied to, and that, you know, there's almost like this lie of freedom, which is really strange, that we have become more free having untethered ourselves from the past, which isn't true. So under the guise of freedom and progress, that we're moving somewhere new and somewhere better, which isn't the case. We've abandoned all of these, all of this ancient wisdom, all of this tradition that, you know, let's say you're in a forest. Would you be able to navigate a forest without, you know, a compass and a map? Well, that's basically what we've done, is we've decided, okay, well, the map and the compass that our ancestors gave us, that they were wrong, that it lies to us. And so it's basically treating these things that have been worked on over time, this wisdom that's been passed on to us, that it's false or evil. And, you know, that, oh, we're free now that we don't have those constraints. But that's not the case. We're actually more free by having the map and the compass, if that makes any sense.
Oh, that's right. Oh, absolutely. It's just like people being dependent on technology, or where AI is going. Are they really empowered and free when they're not going to know how to do anything, and they've just relied on a computer to do everything for them, and then that computer dies?
Right. So, yeah, you're exactly right. Now that they've convinced you that these important things that were gifted to you by your ancestors, a way of understanding reality and knowing, oh, well, you know, here's a moral a code or something. Oh, well, that's all wrong. Well, okay, now you've just opened the door not to be free, but to be controlled by someone else.
Exactly.
Now, yeah, so it's a complete lie.
No, that's why I think, like, ancient philosophy, religions, mythology, and knowledge, the spirituality, we can't let that fade away. And I think those in control want that to fade away, because they know it is so important for us, for, like, true liberation, right? For true enlightenment.
Yes.
And if you don't have those things, you're not grounded in something real and timeless and truthful and classic and ancient, and then you are easily manipulated and controlled, and then it turns into ghetto rap culture, right? And it's like, that's all I see anymore is, like, ghetto rap culture. I even see, like, old ladies listening to this crap in their car. I'm like, do they really like it? And you go to malls, you go to restaurants, you go everywhere you go. It's like ghetto rap culture is now mainstream. I remember when this was like the trashy kids listened to that. You know what I mean? Like the kids in the trailer park might have listened to to that kind of ghetto music or whatever. Now it's just like, oh, it's mainstream. Do you think most people really actually like that? I mean, are they really that dumb?
Like, that's a complicated one. I would definitely say that the masses, if you will, definitely will listen to the hegemon. I mean, we're going on 25 years or so of rap being the main.
It doesn't go away. Like, this is it.
It doesn't.
This
is it. They act like it's new. They act like it's new, and it's not. It's been around for 25 years, and I'm sick and I'm tired of it. And I do think, even though people are persuaded by, you know, oh, what Billboard Top 100 is saying, or what, you know, the people in power are suggesting to people in the media that is good, you know, like, you know, Nicki Minaj or something like that. Despite that, I do think that people who are European or white are getting really tired of this. And you know, obviously people, even though they're persuaded by these entities, they still understand what beauty is. People instinctually still know when they see something that they love. So something that's interesting that's happened is that at least young white kids are really interested in K-pop. And that's kind of a scapegoat because it's not cool to like white culture, but you can Korean. Do it if it's Korean. So if the Koreans are dressing like white boys and they have bleached blonde hair and, you know, like blue eye contacts and are dressing European and, you know, are using all of those traditional instruments, suddenly it's okay. So obviously, even though people are accepting that culture almost like as a virtue signal, that of rap, they still long for European aesthetics, but just not if a white person's doing it, unfortunately.
Well, in those rap videos, they love the fine European cars and the clothes and the bling, well, you know. They love all the fine sheet that we make, you know. Yeah, I mean, American culture sucks, right? And this is what happens when you lose memory of all the cool, old, ancient stuff. This is what happens when you open the doors to, you know, foreigners. And not all these people were brought here through slavery, by the way. There was only like, what, 400,000 African slaves by a few merchants, really. So like merchants. A lot of these came later, right? And it's just like, it just doesn't go away. It's like globalists have decided like, this is where they wanted to stop, you know? This is it. But, but, yeah, this woman, screw it. What are you doing? Humping a goose? That poor goose is call animal control. Like, what the heck? It always ends up being like in the jungle, you know, except in Chicago.
Yes, yes.
But at the same time, I think there's going to be a huge backlash. The people are sick and tired of this shit, too, you know, where they're going to want like beauty and aesthetics and things that sound pleasing. I have a friend that's an interior designer, and she said that she's seeing the trends. And she deals with people like high end also, seeing the trends of people getting tired of the modern, cold, clean lines and like a resurgence of a lot of the old world type of stuff. So she's seeing that, you know, it's there's always been levels of that on the high end, but now we're seeing it like in the mid end, you know, more like upper middle class people who are like wanting to go back to that. And I was like, oh, I saw that as like a little good glimmer of hope of people getting sick and tired of all this other stuff, you know.
Definitely, definitely. And I wouldn't even say that, you know, like that's Western culture. I mean, that's American culture. Unfortunately, it has become American culture. But, you know, what they've done is they've taken something that was once very good. You know, the people who came to this country, you know, had a vision for what they wanted this land and this country to be like. And unfortunately, we're now, you know, forced to accept what was on the screen just there a couple of seconds ago.
No, that's a good point. American culture used to be, oh my, I think of like cowboys and barbecues and discovery and innovation and invention, like all these cool things that there were so many European Americans that just brought the world so much, you know, it's like the age of invention and discovery. And like that forever is, you know, in my mind, like American culture, it fostered that, right? There was a sense of freedom and come claim your land and build your homestead and dream big. And that's what it used to be.
Yes. But to go back to your main point, it's, you know, you can even see in early America that, you know, despite having all of those good values. And, you know, there was a lot of turmoil in Europe, you know, lots of revolutions were happening and people decided to come here and live a simpler lifestyle. But one of the things that they did, you know, the Protestants, if you go to a Protestant church or you look at the Mennonites, their churches are completely void of art. They actually almost have, you know, they
Puritans.
Hate aesthetics. Yes. And so like, while I understand.
Flogging yourself, everything's a sin. I can't look good. I can't be beautiful. I can't wear lipstick. Like, oh my God.
Right. And while I understand that, it's also one of the reasons, like you mentioned, that, you know, we in America are not focused on our roots. We basically have hardly any indicators of our European ancestry. And the way that that's communicated, and this is why culture is important, is through, like, if you go to Europe, it's really hard to not be European because you can see around you, the buildings are constantly.
It's old, it's been there a while, it's established, right? It's, we're still a newer nation.
It's established.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so here, because we basically, you know, started off with too much simplicity, I would argue, and a kind of a denial of culture. Well, I mean, when you deny something, you kind of allow like the negative aspect of that thing to come rushing in. And I think that that's kind of the trajectory of America. Like we almost kind of denied our roots and now we are even like more rootless than ever.
Mm, yeah. And then people are like, well, why did, you know, haters say, well, why did Europeans have to come or whatever? And then we're like, oh, religious freedom. Well, blame religion then. Blame religion. Don't blame.
Well, the argument for that like the Indians were the first people that came here and they have more of a claim to the land than we do. Okay, that's not how civilization works.
Well, yes.
That's not, you know, the way that things work is that, you know, this there wasn't even a country here. There was basically open land with some tribes.
Some nomads running around. They were killing each other too. It wasn't a big kumbaya fest.
Exactly. There were no roads. There was no country. We made the country.
Yes.
So like the argument is ridiculous.
Yeah. And then it's like, okay, if we're invaders, then what makes it okay for all of you to come live here then and enjoy the fruits of what the invaders built, you know?
Yeah.
And then of course we could go back farther with like the Solutrean hypothesis and all of that. And most American Indians today are admixture. They have European DNA as well. So, but it's like, how far back do you want to go? Who was first? Well, how far back? We can uproot the whole planet doing this. Who was first here on the land? Like, history is full of war and conquests and taking land. But what's happening today is different because it's people from within that are turning against their own people to give away the land. And we can't like fight old school like cowboys used to, you know, fight properly on the field or whatever, you know.
Well, and you and I we're not Native American. We don't benefit at all. Like the nature of reality is brutal. We've been very nice to this group of people. We've actually given them land where other groups of people would just completely slaughter them.
Yes.
We've actually been very, very accommodating to this group of people. But of course, we are going to choose ourselves over other groups of people. It doesn't benefit me to, you know, give them everything. I mean, we're not the same group of people. That's the nature of you know, human existence is you have to stand up for your claim to exist and to have land, or else nobody's going to do that for you.
That's right. That's right. So we have a big job because we today, I think it's important, the work that you do as well. And you're looking into history and art and all these things and sharing that with people because we have to cultivate these things and nurture the cultural tree, our culture tree, if you will, for future generations, and it's a huge job, right? And then some people say, well, our culture is vast, so which era do we embrace? Well, what do you say about that? Because for me, I always say, well, whatever speaks to you. And of course, you pull from your own ethnic roots, right? What do you say?
Good question. So I think the probably the best lead that I have is that German Romanticism would be the direction that we would all want to go in, because they seem to really have everything sort of checked out. They're considering everything. It's very balanced. So they would be pulling even from ancient Mesopotamia. You know, someone like Richard Wagner was very well studied in basically every piece of mythology. He would touch on the things that happened in the Near East. He would touch on, you know, elements in Hellenism, but then also would, you know, imbue the mythology with stuff about, you know, Odin or Wotan. So there's something about romanticism and about putting the mystery back in everything and kind of reconnecting with the divine in everything in your life that we've sort of been missing in the West for quite some time. So I think that all of the influences that the German romanticists that were trying to revitalize the spirit of Europe during their time, because Enlightenment had basically taken the life out of everything and they were becoming, you know, rootless. I think that that's the biggest lead, and that would be the biggest inspiration for me and where I see myself going.
I like that. Well, and we're not saying return to the past. We live in the here and now. I've said this. I've heard you say this, too. We're not saying go back to being a 1950s housewife, right? It's not about, it's about not forgetting, like, where your people come from. And I always wonder, are we capable of creating art or stories or mythology today that will be viewed as classical in the future? You know, something that incorporates new mythologies and art to remind future generations of the struggles that we went through, our generations now, so that they don't forget. You know, now we have the internet, you know, which is vast, and so those things can be recorded. But it's like, is it possible to create classics now? We don't know if they're classics, but maybe hundreds of years from now, they'll be viewed as classics. I know. What do you think?
Yeah, we've most certainly done it before in the past. And there's always a group of people who are unique, like Richard Wagner is a good example, or Homer. And these people have just this drive to you know, figure out and you know, like, mythologize our past and create this story and help revitalize culture. That's something that always happens. And these people, honestly, right now are just not being encouraged to do that. But once those people have the go ahead and we understand culturally where we're supposed to head, we have at least you know, a semblance, understanding of who it is that we are, because that's been so eroded. I have absolutely no doubt that we're going to start making, you know, some true classics. It's a cycle. We are, you know, we go through different phases where we're, you know, in a low, and then we have to, you know, get back together with other people and decide, okay, well, what are we really? So I definitely think it's possible. And actually, I think the internet, yes, can be a bad thing, but you can see how powerful a meme can be or a tweet can be if you just, like, hit on the right energy.
Oh, yes.
And the moment that we start figuring out this spirit, this zeitgeist of who it is we really are, and someone talented comes along and decides, you know what, I want to do something vitalistic and life-affirming as opposed to something that's nihilistic and postmodern, which is where all the artists are centering their attention right now in, like, the liberal realm. Once somebody with actual real talent decides to take up that that route and seriously pursues it, no question.
Yeah, you're right. Some memes can be classic. I could see, like, 50 years from now, I could see being an old lady looking back and be like, look at this. It's summarized exactly what we were going through perfectly. It's not the most beautiful art, but it's, like, it's still classic.
There's Cafe's not going anywhere.
There's one story that's very popular, and you have a new video coming out exploring Gothic culture, which I also am interested in. And it's the legend of King Arthur, right, and the Grail. So why is this story so popular? This one seems to never go away.
Yeah, it doesn't. And it's remarkable that it doesn't. And obviously during its time, it was very powerful. And I think the reason why it sticks around is because there's a truth to it. And that's why, you know, the Iliad and the Odyssey is something that still sticks out to us to this day. Or Lord of the Rings, which was inspired by Richard Wagner's Ring Cycle. There are certain mythos that's formed that is almost more true than history. And it's this ability to take the past and amplify all of the aspects of it that are important, because history is basically a recounting of the past that's very secularized. You kind of remove, it's like very mathematical, if you will. It's very scientific. But when you properly mythologize something that happened in the past, it can echo through the ages know, forever. And so this particular story is one that, you know, during the medieval era, communicated something really important to people about, you know, your lineage, and was very life affirming. And in terms of, you know, enlightenment, its meaning sort of changed over time, what it meant to be enlightened. But the story of the Holy Grail kind of gives us an insight into what that used to mean. So yeah, it's popular just because I think it's so true. There's obviously something true about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's always the quest for eternal life, right?
Yes.
Vitality. And there's something transformational about that, alchemical. And I think we all want that journey, right? This can't just be it, right? We want more. We want to evolve into something greater. And I want that personally. And I want that for our, you know, ethnic racial family as well. Right. I think that there's a spiritual reason why we're here and why we exist. And it's not just to, you know, go view poop on a plate in some gallery.
Yes. Yes. And so I actually think that exactly, you know, the narratives and the mythos that we have today takes us away from that. And it's interesting that people during, you know, the medieval era, they were intrigued by this mythology of the Holy Grail and the Knights of the Round Table. And it was very life affirming. And so I really do think that we can gain some insights from that mythology. And maybe it's something that needs to be remythologized and, you know, told to our children so that they can, you know, understand why that quest is important. Because yeah. Now that we've abandoned that, I mean, you know, we're letting all of these people from the third world in. And it seems that those people understood that family was important and that lineages in your bloodlines were a very, very, very important thing.
Absolutely. And other people believe this. All kinds of other people on the planet believe this. We're not unique to believe this. now, in your view, last question, what are ways that you think we can uphold our culture, our ancestors in our modern era? Because this is important to me, it's a form of resistance by upholding our true, you know, culture and our ancestors and not forgetting them.
Yes, good question. I think it's really the children that those are, you know, the people that are really being targeted the most. You'll see the BBC making this erroneous claim that Black people had this big part in British you know, history when they didn't. Why are they doing that? They're doing that because they know that it's the children that are the most persuadable. So if we're going to, you know, revitalize our culture and we're going to, you know, rekindle the spirit of Western civilization, it's going to be reclaiming all of our institutions or making our own, understanding that culture is important, not looking at art as entertainment, and to be more mindful of that consumption. But then, yes, you know, using art as a means to help children understand what their past was and tell them these important stories. And I think it's honestly just focusing on them and imbuing them with the right values that will end up, you know, saving the West, because, you know, they're the future.
You should create a fine arts crash course for the School of the West. He's looking for
more. Thank you. That would be cool.
Material. No, I think that would be great for like homeschoolers to have as part of their, you know, education, their toolkit, if you will.
I'd love to.
I think that would just be awesome, because it's like most of us, we, you know, we don't know like all of art history and like where do you begin and all that. But that would be something that's really needed, I think.
If you could create a course.
Yes, I'll have to put you in touch with them. Okay, now, tell us about your new video podcast series. I know you're kind of examining the current state of Western civilization, exploring how modern liberalism and all these woke narratives are influencing and demoralizing and controlling our identity. Tell us about what you've got going on and how people can find you.
Well, yes, I have a YouTube channel, and it's it's kind
of shame in that. No shame in that.
It's kind of a silly art project, but at the same time, it is informative. And I like to do things in, you know, an unconventional manner because, you know, censorship, you know, when I started the channel was really kicked up a notch. And so I like to address things in a more subtle manner. I don't know
anything about that.
the channel is just generally speaking a kind of more subtle way to talk about these really complicated questions and really just address, you know, who it is that we are, why are we having these problems in relation to culture? Because politics is important, it is, but I think it's politics that's downstream of culture. And I've known this for quite some time. And so if you're able to change the culture and understand it and talk about it properly, then, you know, people will vote correctly. So that's kind of the aim, is to touch on identity. And that's what my channel kind of does, attempts to do.
I love those little TV segments. That's kind of fun.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
A little acting going on in there too. And it's fun. You have to be creative. You have to think outside the box. You have to be artistic. Yes. You can't just come at this and like be just like dry and to the point, totally serious all the time, you know.
We're the normies.
Yes. Yeah, you have to find like, yeah, exactly. You have to find like roundabout ways, interesting ways to convey these topics. Like, you know, because white people are interesting, you know, all kinds of different ways that they need to be reached, you know, all kinds of different personalities and weird little hangups. And
yes, and it's valuable to be direct. It 100% is, but it's also valuable to have a different approach for people that, you know, kind of need to have the seed planted, if you will, and kind of think that they're the ones who came up with the idea. Yeah. Some people are like that.
It's a healthy subversive.
I think it's a good, I think it's a really important thing to understand how to communicate in an artistic manner, is what I try to do. Because when you're speaking artistically, when you're communicating in that manner, you're communicating on multiple different levels. Where like logic and reason may, you know, fail most people, you know, it's these other things that really are true. Once they feel them, now it's going to register with them and they're going to understand it a lot better.
Yeah. And also just having finesse. I think of how the English language, how people used to convey these ideas with this rich vocabulary and these like the ways that they would, you know, share their experiences and things that they were going through, or like ways that they would insult people that just sounded beautiful.
versus
today. Like, wow.
Yes,
man.
We need to take on that approach too. Yeah, we need to have some subtlety and artfulness, but it's also just as valid to just be like cutthroat and just say how it is.
Yeah. All depends who you're dealing with and who your target audience is.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for your time today. It's been a blast getting to know you and hearing all about what you do. And I'm sure we'll see a lot more of you around the internet.
Yes. Thank you, Lana. It was really nice talking to you. I'm honestly very flattered that you would have me on.
We'll do it again sometime. Okay.
Yes, definitely. Thank you.
It's indeed a culture war, but the other side, they don't have any. Do what you can to honor your roots. Your ancestors are watching. Help support us. The best way is through getting a Red Ice membership or sending us a donation. Just simply go to redicemembers.com where you will find all the options. It's all of you that help keep us in the fight. A special thanks to our executive producers, T. Lothrop Stoddard, V. Miller, Resin Revolts, Good Luck Lap, Jake, Red Pill Rundown, French 47, Mark Smith, No One Jeebs, President Obunga, Mongoose, William Fox, Angry White Soccer Mom, The Second Wanderer, Operation Werewolf, The Ride Never Ends, Francis Parker Yaki, Dill Bob, Last Place Simp, Joseph Hart, Purple Haze, Colin Marriott, Commie Combo Deal, The Dearborn Toxic Events, Brendan Anthony, and 55 Club Books. And a special thanks to our producers, Mr. Walker 696, Johansson, Leroy DeMond, Snarkpup, Eyes Open, Mr. Lemry, Yurinu, Obadiah Hakeswill, Perfect Brute, Single Action Army, HP Lovecraft, Dixie Drone Force, and 55clubbooks.com. If you'd like to help us and become an executive producer, head over to our Subscribestar or redicemembers.com or Odyssey. That's it for now. We'll see you on the next one.